In verses 7 through 11, he's speaking about patiently enduring the suffering that they're really going through in regard to the contents of verses 1 through 6. The rich are oppressing them, and they're manipulating them and exploiting them. And the brethren need to be patiently enduring that. And we spoke about that, and that's kind of what pertains to question 5, but we spoke about that patience, that endurance, as not a passive thing, but an active thing, where they're Christians, so they're living for the Lord, and they can't let the oppression of the rich deter them from continuing to serve the Lord. And so this patience is, it's, you know, dealing with the pain and the anguish and the suffering, but as you're continuing to do something, you're pushing through the pain, you're continuing to run the race, if you will. And I think we understand endurance in that case most times. It's when we talk about it as it's translated patience sometimes that we need to clarify. It's not just passively, patiently waiting, but it's actively doing something. You talk about endurance in athletics. I ran cross country in high school. You really had to endure. You had to push through the stitch in your side. You had to push through the pain. And enduring means you don't stop running and you don't run slower. You try to keep the pace. You endure through. And so that's the idea, is you keep serving the Lord even though these bad things are happening. He mentioned the farmer as the first of three examples of patience, endurance. We spoke about that. And then in verse 9, he kind of throws in a parenthetical thought, and it kind of switches gears from him speaking about do this and be positive in this manner and patiently endure because there's your reward that's laid up for you. You're looking forward to that. And also vengeance will be paid. The Lord is in control. And so those people that have been treating you wrong, you know, justice will be served. So two things you have to look forward to, but you got to patiently endure. Then he kind of looks to the opposite, really the forfeiture of the goal that they're looking forward to if they aren't patiently enduring. And specifically, the way they would fail is, or he mentions and warns them not to do, is to grumble against one another. And so oftentimes we go under hardships, we can kind of find ourselves struggling with that. We complain against those who really have nothing to do with what we're going through and put the blame on them, or at least, you know, take out our aggression on them when it's not even their fault. Or maybe we just vent to others. So we're grumbling to someone about our situation. That's not acceptable either. We need to be positive people, optimistic people. And as Philippians chapter 2 indicates, as we work out our own salvation with fear and trembling, we do all things without complaining or disputing because we're children of God. And so we need to be that example. So in verse 10, he picks back up with the second out of three examples of patience. He says, "My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed to endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful." And so the prophets, they are an example of patience. How was their patience exhibited? What often brought upon their heartaches and struggles and sufferings? And then how did they show they persevered through it? Okay. Yeah, rejoicing and thanksgiving. You know, even the apostles were told to, and us Christians are told to, you know, 1 Peter is probably the main text we think about, is to rejoice that we get to partake in the sufferings of the Lord, right? Paul, he left all, Philippians 3 says, and counted it as rubbish to gain Christ so that he can actually be more acquainted with Christ's sufferings. And that's an impressive sentiment. You know, you think of someone like Elijah is, you know, the main prophet, even in the Hebrew mind, how he had challenged Ahab, the probably the most wicked king in Israel, and you know, slayed the prophets of Baal and all that kind of stuff. He had a time of struggle where he kind of, you know, retreated back when Jezebel was seeking to take his life, and he was moping under a broom tree and hiding in a cave. And then we have that scene of God demonstrating, you know, where the power actually is and his voice and his words. And so just do my words, and I've reserved other people who are faithful to the Lord and haven't bowed their knee to Baal as well. And Paul mentions that in Romans 11 to speak about the remnant that's always been. And so he had a struggle at a time, but as he gained strength and encouragement by God's word, he continued to speak God's word, even in the midst of struggle. Jeremiah the prophet is, you know, one of the greatest examples of that. The weeping prophet who prophesied to his own people about the sins that they were involved in and the judgment they were bringing upon themselves. And they didn't get mad at God. I mean, they were, but they took it all out on Jeremiah. And he bore the brunt of that. That's really what is the pattern of those who reject the truth. You know, hardly ever do people who are professing to be followers of God just say, oh, actually, I don't like the Bible anymore. They always claim to still like the truth and to love God's word, and then they put it all on the person speaking it, either telling him that they've got it wrong, even though they don't, or just kind of maligning his character and tearing down the man because the man is preaching what the book says. And so they endured by continuing to speak the word of the Lord, even in the midst of that persecution, even in the midst of that suffering. Jesus said a little bit about this in Matthew 5 in the Beatitudes. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you for my name's sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So Jesus is a case in point of that as well. When he speaks about he sent the prophets, he sent these teachers, and you killed them. And then he sent his son, you killed him too. And so the endurance of that is to continue to speak in the name of the Lord no matter what. Anything on that? You know, and that's that concept in 1 Peter about suffering for doing good. He's not talking about, like, you know, if you just keep doing good, God will preserve you from any bad. That's actually the opposite point. He's saying they can never take away your hope. They can never take away your standing with God. In Romans 8, it talks about that too. They can't separate you from the love of Christ. You will always be able to serve God faithfully. No one can ever stop you doing that. And if they take your life, you know, blessed are those who die in the Lord. And so that's what perseverance is. That's what endurance is. And the world kind of takes away from that in the gospel of health and wealth when they act like God wants nothing but sunshine and rainbows for us on this earth. While he wants what's good for us on this earth, and he never wills anything bad to happen to his children, he allows bad things to happen to mold us and shape us, to test our faith so we can prove to him that we are true to him and that we are persevering in these ways. And those who do persevere are blessed in the end. And that doesn't mean they have a smile on their face necessarily through all the pain. It means that they rejoice in the heart through all the pain, knowing that there's a reward. And that's what James started with, counting it joy when you fall into various trials. What is the last example he gives, and what do we know about him? He said, you've heard of it, so what have we heard about him? What is so impressive with Job's story, and how is there a demonstration with him about the compassionate and merciful characteristics of God, the end he intends for us through all this pain? Specifically with Job, what happened to him and how did it end?
Well, he pretty much had all the conflicts that were put on, you know, losing his family, losing his house, losing everything. The boils, everything.
Yeah.
His wife cursed at him, basically. His, all three of those friends were just like naysayers, if you will.
Yeah.
And he just basically said, hey, God's got it under control for me, basically, if I remember it right. And in the end, he was given overfilling.
Yeah.
Really, with what he lost. I mean, that's worldly. Yeah, the worldly part of it. But he persevered and he won the race, if you will.
Yeah, and that's just his point, I think. I don't think he's saying that if you look at Job, you know, if you endure this, you're going to be rich more than you were before. But it's like this figurative parallel, if you will. This is what God intends for us, is to have all the riches in heaven, fellowship with him for eternity if we endure through this. And Job suffered more than anyone we can think of in Scripture, save the Lord himself. And so he blessed the latter days of Job more than this beginning. Yeah.
I think the greater point is that the Lord knows what we are going. The Lord can acknowledge and know what we are going through, and that's you know, as an employer and employee relationship, a lot of times that's the most powerful thing is, like, I've had a lot of employees come to me and say, you know, you don't understand, such and such is doing this. I'm like, no, I know that. Yeah. But if I do this, then this happens. If I do this, this happens. They're like, oh, yeah. You know, like, you know, they don't understand the overall, like, yeah I do understand, but let me show you a greater, a 30,000 foot view. And I think that that's a very powerful point of this, is that the Lord will take care of us and he knows what we're going through.
Yeah.
It might be in this life, like Job was taken care of physically, but it might be in the life to come. But either way, the Lord knows what we're going through.
Definitely. And that's kind of the message of Job, or one of the messages we can learn, because it you know, it wasn't like the 42 chapters of Job were just completely clean and perfect. You know, his endurance, his perseverance was not, you know, that he never doubted whatsoever. He never questioned whatsoever. He learned his lesson not to test God in that way. You know, at the beginning it spoke about, in all this he did not sin with his lips. He wasn't charged with wrong. But then as his friends, like you were saying, kind of doubted his righteousness, he almost got defensive, but he was right in that. He hadn't done anything wrong. And then that changes to, like, God, why are these things happening? What have I done? You know, I'm faithful to you. And then God puts him in his place. But when you take it all as a whole, it's like Steve was saying, that you kind of see that God's in control. I mean, who controls nature? Who makes sure the sea doesn't overflow? Questions like that. Who designed, you know, the animals to act in this way? He looks at all of these things to show how great God is, how in control he is, and that, you know, you have no right to question him. Instead, you should just, you know, be quiet and persist and persevere. And Job had persevered. Even though he had some struggles, he never lost his faith in God. And in the end, he was better for it, you know, ultimately, as God corrected him, and then he saw the big picture. And so when he's talking about perseverance and endurance, he's not saying that, you know, if you're suffering for doing good and you have any doubt ever cross your mind whatsoever, that you're the worst Christian ever to live. He's not saying that. That's not what perseverance is. It actually impresses us with the inclusion of those struggles. You know, even Jesus said, he never sinned at all, ever, but we can't take away from his humanity when he said, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. He was feeling it. He never doubted God. He never showed a spirit of rebellion in any way, but in his flesh, as he was anticipating the suffering, he thought, you know, if there's a way out, God, you know, let's take it. And there wasn't, and he submitted. That's perseverance. And so, you know, someone's asked me before is, you know, how are we supposed to view doubts? If you ever doubt whatsoever in any way, do you sin in doing so? You know, that's not necessarily the case. Do you yield to those doubts? Do you pursue those doubts? Or do you, you know, with faith, completely deny them and say, I don't want this. Lord, increase my faith. Remember that man? He said, increase my faith. Help my unbelief. But the apostle said, increase my faith. He said, I believe, help my unbelief. You know, that should be the spirit we have. We're ever increasing and growing, which means each day we're further along than we were the day before. And that's not a bad thing. That's actually a good thing. And so it's that upwards projection, persevering in that way and not allowing these things to deter you from doing good. In chapter 1, he said in verse 12, the one who endures will receive the crown of life. That's the end intended by the Lord. There's something positive at the end. So question 5 is, we don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but given those 3 examples James supplies, what can we learn about the patience required of Christians? What does it look like?
Well, we have examples that it can be done, it's feasible. These people have gone through things that are far more devastating than probably what we'll ever encounter.
Yeah, that's a great point, that there is nothing we could, you know, conceive in our minds that would be too great for us with God's help to endure. You know, and these are definitely, I don't know that we'll ever go through what the prophets and Job went through, but, you know, what we do go through, we can definitely endure. That's a good point.
We see this happen, and we know that it turned out well, so prior knowledge is great power.
Definitely. And, you know, in Romans 15 and verse 4, it says that, you know, things written before were written, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. That patience and comfort is, look at how these people were patient, how they did persevere, look at how they were comforted and why they were comforted, and you can know that you're God's children too, and you can have the same resources. That's definitely how God strengthens us through His Word, by all those examples. You know, so that patience is possible, and it's this idea of this actively doing God's Word, even in the midst of these trials. Anything else on that section? Yes?
Through persistency and endurance, we get that strength.
Yeah.
And if we are not focusing on the prize, which is to be able to see God in heaven, we're not going to have that motivation to keep going. So we keep that prize in front of us. I mean, when you're running an endurance race, you're not thinking about that start line.
Right.
You're thinking about that goal.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, you got to keep moving forward.
Absolutely. Can't look back. All right. Will someone read verse 12, please, of James 5?
It says, "But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment."
Okay, so it's possible he's just switching things up, and he's nearing the end of his epistle, and this is super important. He says, but above all, it's noting some kind of importance with this particular thing he's addressing, and he wants to get to it because he knows it's a problem among his readers, you know, before he ends his epistle. Not that he didn't plan it, but it needs to be in here, and maybe it's not even associated with this context, but it's also very possible that, you know, in a context of suffering, we may be inclined to, even if we're not telling the truth, take Peter for a case in point. We're not telling the truth, but we're afraid of what will happen if we did tell the truth, so we tell a lie, and we reinforce it with taking an oath so that people won't doubt us, and you can't, that's not enduring, that's not any better than grumbling against one another. That's not patience, that's not perseverance. That actually completely undercuts what we're supposed to be as people of truth. Very possible. But we should at very least just take verse 12 at its value by itself and understand it. But I think in order to understand it, we got to look beyond James. What do these words in verse 12 sound like? Can you think of another part of Scripture?
Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah, absolutely. In Matthew 5, when Jesus is correcting some traditions held, but also some false views of the law, and at the same time, he's not just saying that you've got the law wrong and this is what the law is. He is establishing kingdom law, so he's being more strict than the law of Moses. We need to understand that with the Sermon on the Mount. He's going above and beyond even what Moses' law dictates, and stressing, you know, we could say the spirit of the law, but that's really what the law of Christ does, is it goes beyond just the letter, and it gets to a more strict, transforming power that is in the gospel. And so you've got what James says is almost identical in parts to what Jesus says in Matthew 5. And so I think in order to understand, and we'll see another place in Matthew 23 in a minute, but in order to understand what James is saying about swearing, we need to see, I think, what Jesus is saying, because it's certainly the same concept. Before we get there, though, in verse 12 of James 5, he says, do not swear by heaven or by earth or with any other oath. I don't believe that this is a blanket condemnation on oath-taking, period. We got to understand the text in order to know what they're actually saying. Some would suggest that every single oath whatsoever is sinful. But when he says any other oath, he uses the word allos. And what allos is it's another of the same sort. And the other word for other is heteros, and it's another of a different sort. And so it's the difference between someone handing you an apple and saying, I want another, and you're speaking about another apple, it's the same sort, or another, and what you're really meaning is another piece of fruit. So it could be a banana. Does that make sense? It's different. It's not the exact same, but it's in the same class. It's in the same, not even just the same class like fruit, but it's the same fruit. So it's an apple, but it's a different apple. Does that make sense? And so when he says, nor with any other oath, he's speaking about something specific. And so it may be heaven or by earth or with any other thing, but it falls into a same context of abuse that he's talking about. And it's the same thing Jesus is talking about. So when we go over to Matthew 5, I'm trying my best to get through this. So in Matthew 5, he says again in verse 33, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord.'" I believe that's basically a summation of what the law says. It's not a quote directly from the Old Testament, but a summation. Then he says, "But I say to you, do not swear at all." But then he qualifies that. So, you know, Paul says, "All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful." He's not saying everything under the sun is lawful, because then there would be no sin. He's saying all things that are lawful are lawful. And so when Jesus says, "Do not swear at all," he kind of qualifies his statement. What does he mean by all? "Neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one." So we can even further understand Jesus' words by seeing what James says too, when he adds "any other" of the same sort. And so when Jesus says, "Do not swear at all," he's speaking about this kind of swearing. This kind of swearing that undermines truth, has ulterior motives, and is swearing by things the law never allowed in the first place. But there's also a distinction to be made by why they were swearing by those things. So in the law, the general idea was, "You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord." They made a different emphasis than what the law made. In Leviticus 19 and verse 12, there's an important passage concerning swearing and then performing oaths. Leviticus 19 and verse 12, I'm reading from the New King James Version. In Leviticus 19 and verse 12, it says, "You shall not swear by my name falsely, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." In the Hebrew, the negative in that second part is not there. And there are some translations that reflect it. So the ASV says, "You shall not swear by my name falsely and profane the name of the Lord your God." And so they're not two separate issues. He's saying, if you swear by my name falsely, you profane the name of the Lord your God. He's not saying, don't swear by my name. He's saying, don't swear by my name falsely. And you notice in verse 11, the emphasis is on dealing falsely or lying to one another. And so he's not talking about taking an oath in the Lord's name as being sinful, or even taking an oath in the Lord's name and not performing that oath is sinful. He's speaking about lying versus telling the truth. He's speaking about saying you're going to do something and doing it versus saying you're going to do something and then not doing it. So in Matthew 5, when he says, "You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord," that's the general summation of the law. But this is how the Pharisees emphasized it. "You shall not swear by swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord." When they should have emphasized, "You shall not swear falsely, period, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord." So what they were essentially saying is that we must perform our oaths if we swear by the Lord. But we don't have to perform our oaths if we swear by heaven, or if we swear by earth, or if we swear by Jerusalem, or if we swear by our head. You see the point? It was kind of a loophole. And so they're saying this, "I swear I'll do this, I'm vowing to do this," and never intending to do it. And in order to justify themselves in their own mind, they wouldn't swear by God, even though that's what the old law required. It didn't say ever swear by any place or thing. It says, don't swear by other gods. If you swear, you swear by Jehovah, and you must perform those oaths. And so what they would do is say, "I swear it, but by heaven or by earth." And to them, that was a loophole. That's not as big. It's huge to swear by the name of Jehovah. You better do what you said. But it's not a big deal to swear by this and then to not do it. Does that make sense? Yes.
I'm seeing a connection here also, is that we do not control heaven. We do not
exactly
control the earth.
Yes.
We don't control any of these things except for what we say yes or no.
Right. And but who does control it?
God.
And that's kind of the point he's making. You can't avoid God and taking oaths, and really the primary way to understand that is God is truth. And so if you're saying you're telling the truth, even if you say it's by heaven or by oath or whatever, even just saying, I'm telling the truth, and you're not swearing by anything, you're going to be held to that by God because God is truth. But they thought, you know, I can avoid God by saying heaven or earth, but heaven is where God is. God created earth. It's his footstool. Jerusalem is connected with God in worship with the Jews, and so you can't avoid it. That's further manifested in Matthew 23. The same concept is made, and it's a further commentary on itself in Matthew 23. So turn there real quick. Anybody have anything while we're turning there, though?
I read a secular book. It was about like history of this time. It was covering Matthew chapter 5, and they had said basically like, it was almost like how we used, I was crossing my fingers and, you know, no tag bat, like yeah. All this, like, they had these like funny, like crazy yeah. things that they were doing that it almost got out of hand. Like, yeah. they were like, I swear by Pluto and this and that. Yeah. You know, it was just like these crazy things, and you never knew whether to believe somebody or not.
Exactly.
It was like you said, like some sort of loophole.
Yeah. And, you know, so he's addressing a specific vice, common in the cult, in the day, period, but definitely a problem among the Jews. They had really been guilty of this, just in everyday language, dropping, you know, oaths like they were nothing and they didn't really mean anything. As to what they said, it was just, you know, they're trying to impress people with their words and such. And in Matthew 23, with the woes of the scribes and Pharisees, you really see the point brought in. And he's talking about the same thing that he did in Matthew 5. James is talking about the same thing. That's kind of unavoidable. They're using the same concepts, the same terminology. So in Matthew 23 and verse 16, he says, "Woe to you blind guides who say whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it." And what he's not saying is that you need to swear by gold instead of swearing by the temple. He's saying that all of it is connected. All of it is connected with God. You can't avoid it. And so notice the emphasis that he places. It is nothing versus he is obliged to perform it. That's the point. And so when he says, "You shall not swear falsely, but perform your oaths to the Lord," their idea is, you shall perform your oaths to the Lord. Completely ignore the "you shall not swear falsely" part. Swearing falsely in any way, shape, or form is wrong before God. Their idea was, I can swear falsely as long as I swear by the gold or the altar, the temple, so on and so forth, heaven, earth. But he's saying that's not at all the case. You need to just tell the truth. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. In his commentary, Hendrickson said, "In order to make an impression, a person might utter such an oath, talking big and dispensing enormous promises. And if the affirmation which he had made was a lie, or if the promise was never meant to be kept, that was not so bad, as long as he had not sworn to the Lord." That was their idea. And Jesus is condemning him. So remember, when he says, "Do not swear at all" in Matthew chapter 5, as well as in James chapter 5, it is narrowed to that context he's speaking about. And that's why James, I think, in James 5 and verse 12 says, "Alas, by any other oath, other of this sort." He's not saying oaths, period, but this kind of swearing where you're finding a loophole, you're not intending to keep it, you're swearing by other things, thinking that that means that you cannot fulfill or you don't have to fulfill what you've sworn. The emphasis in the old law, even in the context of swearing, was always truth. Now, there were guidelines laid down. You can't swear by other gods. You can't swear by other things. The only example we have, the only command, and there was a command for them to take vows and swear, was by the Lord. But the emphasis was always, you do what you swear to do. You speak truth. You don't speak lies. It always has to be performed. And so the emphasis was not just on to the Lord versus other things, but in not swearing falsely. You speak the truth, which is why Jesus went on to say, "Let your yes be yes and your no, no, for what is ever more than these is of the evil one," because the general practice was, we're not truthful people, we're not honest, we cannot be relied upon, our word is not true, and that's why we're in this thing. And Jesus is saying, in my kingdom, my people who are following me, and I'm the way, the truth, and the life, they're characterized by truth. So your yes should be so strong that all you have to do is say yes. Your no should be so trustworthy that all you have to do is say no. And when he says, whatever is more than these is from the evil one, that article one is not in the Greek. And so the New American Standard Bible renders it, anything beyond these is of evil. ESV, anything more than this comes from evil. Albert Barnes commented saying it means it proceeds from some evil disposition or purpose. That's exactly what he's saying. If you're doing this, it kind of tells me right off the bat that you're not telling the truth. You know, if you're just going on and on about, I swear by this, I swear by that, believe me, because I'm swearing by this, I'm swearing by that, can't believe you, can't trust a person like that. I think we all can understand that. But a Christian should have his character proven by his actions and by his words. In contrast to chapter 3 of James, where you're speaking out of both sides of your mouth, you should have a proven character that you tell the truth. And so you should be content with just saying yes or just saying no, not coming from evil motives. Does that make sense?
As I was reading this, I came across a thought that why do people of the world now, many centuries later, swear at all? Well, they, you know, I swear to do this.
Yeah.
And it's they're perk up, but it's to be more convincing in a lie that's
right
going to come subsequently.
Yeah. And so there's intention behind this as well. You know, what Jesus is, James is saying is that if you're living like you're supposed to do and you're that acquainted with truth and you love truth that much, you don't need to say anything more than yes or no. You know, because, it, you know, if you're falling into this, any other oath, these of this sort, this common practice, then essentially you are a liar, you're a hypocrite, which is what's interesting. It says, lest you fall into judgment in James 5 and verse 12. Depending on your translation, you might see a little notation by that. Mine has a notation, and in the center column reference, it says that it mentions hypocrisy, 5 and verse 12. Yeah, it says hypocrisy in the text that is the majority text. And so it's a difference in manuscripts based on what your particular translation is. And so most people take it to mean judgment, but I'm actually more persuaded that he did mean hypocrisy. Hypocrisis is the word that is used there in the New King James Version, the manuscripts it's taken from. And we know what a hypocrite is. You know, you're playing like you're something that you're not. That kind of fits directly into this. Sure, you'll be judged. You'll be condemned for it. But you have, as one who is supposed to be truthful, faithful, trustworthy, have fallen into this category of being a hypocrite. How terrible is that for a Christian to be characterized as that? And so don't do this lest you fall into hypocrisy. You don't want to be a hypocrite. You don't want to be guilty of that. You certainly don't want to be judged from doing that and being guilty of that. Anything on that? All right, we have a few minutes. So another thing that comes up when we talk about this is, you know, this idea of being under oath in the court of law. And I would advise you to, you know, obviously go with your conscience. Don't ever violate your conscience. But I don't think that it would be accurate to say that Jesus is, and James is, condemning taking or speaking under oath in the court of law, that a person who does that is sinning. If it violates your conscience, then you're going to sin if you do it. But when he says, again, any other oath, he's qualifying what he's talking about, and it's this vice, this flippant oath-taking and doing it to convince others of a lie you're telling, not actually being put under oath in a court of law. Take, for instance, in Hebrews 6, God's promise to Abraham. It says God made a promise to Abraham in Hebrews 6 and verse 13 because he could swear by no one greater. He swore by himself. Surely blessing, I will bless you, and multiplying, I will multiply you. And he explains why. Men indeed swear by the greater. God swore. And an oath for confirmation is for them an end of all dispute. What he's saying is that something as solemn as an oath is needed in some contexts of life for men to feel like they can rely upon what is being said. And so God took advantage of that understanding. He swore by himself he was determining to show more abundantly, verse 17, to the heirs of promise, the immutability of his counsel, so he confirmed it by an oath. He made a promise, he took an oath. And he did that to show that you can count on his promises. God swore. Remember Jesus, Caiaphas put him under oath. Now what Jesus didn't say is that you know that that's wrong. Jesus did not condemn him. Jesus didn't say, I swear either, but then he spoke the truth. He told him what he wanted to hear after he was placed under oath. He didn't refuse to do it. He spoke under oath. Even the Apostle Paul said many times in his epistles, I call heaven and earth as witness against me. You know, my planning was true. That's a form of oath taking. In 1 Thessalonians 5, in verse 27, he actually placed the Thessalonians under oath. He said, I charge you by the Lord that this epistle be read to all the holy brethren. The word charge, horkizo, it means to put on oath and to make swear, Strong says. He put them under oath. And so there's a solemnity with that matter. And Jesus, God, and Paul, in Revelation, it speaks about an angel taking an oath. They're not doing it flippantly. They're not doing it because their character is unproven, that they tell lies all the time and they can't be trusted and they want someone to believe their lie. It's something that is appropriate at times. The majority of our days, it's not appropriate to be, you know, saying oaths, let your yes be yes and your no, no. Don't fall into this vice. And it's part of our culture as well. But certainly he's not condemning the taking of oaths in the court of law. The reason why the courts require that is because there are people that can't be trusted and they want to make sure your word is true and stress on you the solemnity and the gravity of this situation. And there's nothing wrong with doing that unless it goes against your conscience. You know, they offer to, you know, affirm, confidently affirm or whatever the phrase is. But that, I don't really even see a distinction between that. It's you're taking an oath. And so, you know, we need to understand what they're really teaching. Anything on that? Don't have much time, but...